Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. It's March 24th, 2016, and Guillaume doesn't care.
That's right.
Skype has ruined us all. Week three of the Skype tortures continue. I'm your host, James Jones. With me today is the eternal optimist, Mr. Guillaume Veillette.
Yeah, a Windows problem, really. Brought on by Skype. I don't know. Skype was a Trojan horse. This goes deep. The conspiracy is real.
Also with me today, John, you there, buddy?
Yeah. Been here the whole time, enjoying the Codec Maelstrom.
Isn't that what we're calling the RPG Maelstrom?
Yeah. Well, it's Codec Gate, I guess, if you prefer.
We're not going there. Anyway, also joining me today, Greg, I don't have anything to go with you, so Mr. Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
Hello, Greg. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. And for whatever reason, isn't this all my fault at some point? Because for whatever reason, we decided, you know, Skype's misbehaving, so we should definitely bring a fifth person into the equation. Mr. Ren McNulty.
Hey! Oh my god. And yeah.
Yep.
Skype and Windows are the biggest Trojan horse pieces of software.
To be fair, the iPad didn't fix it either. So at this point, just fate is conspiring to end this podcast. So that's fine.
I didn't have issues when using the iPad. The call did.
We've gotten through worse. I mean, I recorded an episode without power and internet one time. We can make this work. I also recorded an episode of sleep, you assholes. Okay, are we good? All right, moving on. So
covering all bases.
But we're going to do new business because we didn't do new business last week. That's not now playing, although I sometimes mix the two segments up. I'm a fallible human being. And there's actually kind of a interesting mix of stuff to go through, but Seren actually has a bunch of stuff that's just not out here yet.
Seren plays
a lot of games from Japan, and there are a lot of Nintendo-related games from Japan that maybe they have names and release dates now, or maybe they just are told they're coming, but we don't have them yet. So let's go in order of interesting.
So I have been playing, I guess is the word, I've been using Miitomo.
Experiencing.
If you aren't aware, this is Nintendo's first iOS and Android app. If you recall the last time I was on the podcast, I talked all about Japanese mobile apps and the sort of state of the Japanese App Store Union, as it were, where Square Enix, Level 5, and Gung Ho basically dominated everything. And
right.
Miitomo is currently the number one app in the Japanese App Store.
By downloads or by grossing?
Top download. It's not even in the top 100 grossing.
okay.
Yeah. It had over a million users in 3 days, probably because it is basically the entire front page of the Japanese App Store. Apple is getting behind this in a big way. So what it is essentially you boot it up and you create or import your Mii, basically Tomodachi Life. It has the name pronunciation, it has the voice settings, it has the personality settings, it has everything you remember from Tomodachi Life. I've been playing it in English because this is what's called a universal ROM, so if your phone system is set to English, the Japanese app runs with the English localization. So the way it works is I think the first question your Mii asks you is, what's your favorite food? And you can type in, I think for mine I got really specific, just to test its pronunciation. I said, 12 ounces of sirloin steak cooked medium well. And pronounced it no problem, got the abbreviation. It has a better text to voice than Tomodachi Life did. It has vastly improved. And then your Mii, you can just sort of close the app, and your Mii will go tell everyone in your friends list that answer. So I have Nintendo World Report's contributor Don Koopman on my list, and so my Mii goes to his room and says, whether he's there or not, and if he misses it, then his Mii will tell him later, saying, hey, Seren came over and told me her favorite food was 12 ounces of sirloin steak cooked medium well. And then he can comment, he can like, and if he comments, that's where the bulk of Miitomo is creating these comment threads. Some of the questions get really weird, like, which female celebrity do you think is going to make it big soon? and you can put whatever you want. But the interesting thing is comments, where anyone who's a friend of that original comment can see the full comments list, and you get 200 characters of fully voiced, no profanity filter. Any word in the entire English language will be said out loud by these me's.
That's kind of surprising, because the built-in library, the built-in dictionaries in the 3DS have censored even like French Canadian swears.
Absolutely, but those
reside on the 3DS, right? Not in Tomodachi Life.
That's part of the system firmware.
Right.
Without going too deep, basically what happens is whenever a developer calls up the keyboard, when you hit OK, it scans it through the system's profanity filter. Individual developers aren't typing out every single swear word.
Alrighty, two things. One, we have Tomodachi Life for Guillaume on his phone, so we'll never see him again. And two, we have infinite swearing, so John will be pleased.
So, yes.
Well, I can be pleased by infinite swearing as well. That's something we can all enjoy.
But here's an interesting thing. In the English localization, so it's only out in Japan right now, so the vast majority of my friends on my friends list are people living in Japan, even if most of them are using the app in English. And if your phone is set to Japanese and you listen to an English answer, it tries to pronounce it as katakana.
God damn
it. It's broken and it's hilarious.
Because there's nothing I ever want to hear more than a Japanese robot trying to do Japanese people reading English poorly.
Are you sure, Jamesu?
Oh, god damn it. Like, it's bad enough. It's bad enough with a human being do it. But with a robot? No, I don't need this.
If I were to set my app to French, like, would we be able to still be able to be friends on Mitomo, or?
Absolutely. And it wouldn't have issues. The issues reside when you're switching alphabets.
Okay.
But
you, in what language would you get my answers?
If you type your answers in French, the question comes out in English and the answer comes out in French.
Oh,
it's
okay.
Just reading what you typed. It's not localizing your answers.
Hmm.
Because it's basically a tweet.
So Guillaume either gets to be an asshole to his francophone friends or his anglophone friends.
Yeah, I guess so.
You have to pick a side, sir.
So Don came to me. Don's me came into my room once and said, this was still early days, and said, "Hey, what do you think is my best quality? This will only be seen between the two of us." So I got, basically, it instigated a private message between the two of us and no one else, prompted by the top, like the subject line, "What is Don's best feature?" So I'm pretty sure I said,
his resilience?
This is going to get dark, James.
This is already dark, John.
Yeah. So,
Suspension Railway Simulator.
So, and then he can comment, and then I can comment, and we can keep that thread separate. But all of this is completely free. There's zero paywalls for anything I've discussed. There are two forms of currency. There's coins. Okay, there's
and
three.
And there's love.
No, there's three forms of currency.
Oh.
So there's Mitomo coins, and candy. So coins are what you buy with premium currency, but you get small amounts of it for answering questions, for listening to questions, for reading the comments, for posting comments, for liking, for getting likes. Basically, everything you do gets you small amounts of coins, or you can buy up to, I think, $80 in coin packs. It's not best value, though. It's just $80 in coin packs. So, if you were to go into someone else's room, you can just invite yourself into someone else's room in this game. Yeah. So if I go into Danny Bivens' room, I can see all of his... I can just cycle through all of his answers to questions. And let's say he's answered 40 questions that I haven't heard the answer to. I can get through about four of them for free. And then he's like, I want to talk. Give me some candy. So, so the candy you can't actually even buy. You have to win it.
That's our Danny.
You have to win it in pachinko. Because there's pachinko in this game.
Oh, man.
So, the In pachinko, there are two types of ways to win, things to win. There's costumes and candy. Now, if you it costs 500 coins or one game ticket, which is the fourth currency I forgot about, to try for pachinko. 99% of the time, you're going to get candy. Candy's like the bottom of the pit. Candy's like the consolation prize. I currently have like I think 30 pieces of candy.
So you never actually lose candy, really?
Not really, because the way... That's like... If just, we're thinking about this as Twitter...
Just feed Danny.
Let's think of this as Facebook. So, candy is used for scrolling down a specific person's profile page, whereas looking through your feed of everything congregated is completely free, and you can go through every single person's answers that way. I can see all of Danny's answers, but if I want to see just Danny's, I use candy.
Makes sense. Sorry.
So, not really. It's understandable what it is. It doesn't make sense why you would do it.
Yeah.
But, so then, the other thing is there's a shop for clothing outfits. For just, you know, accessories, shirts, tops, dresses, skirts, shoes, hats. And the storefront changes out every 24 hours. So far... If you're playing with a female me like I am, since the first day, there hasn't been anything appealing whatsoever. If you want tuxedos, oh, they have a new one for you every day. So it's, or if you want hot dog costumes and dinosaur costumes, they have plenty of those. So it's this weird...
Sounds just like Japan.
What about tuxedo dinosaurs?
None yet. Check back daily. Also, the pachinko setups change out monthly.
John's scale sona is a dinosaur tuxedo.
But I like it for the comments, which is the weirdest thing, because I hate internet comments with a burning passion. But the fact that it is so hard to add friends, and we'll get to this, they've made it harder than it was, like almost as complicated to add a friend as it was on the Wii. Because of that, I'm only seeing, like, my inner circle of friends and their answers, and then we can, like, actually, like, strike up dialogues in the comments, or just, like, I can ask, and I'll get a, they'll get a notification and respond, like, in a couple minutes. And it's this interesting sort of icebreaker app where it asks you a bunch of seemingly simple questions, and then you can actually get some really interesting answers. And... they've gone on record as saying that's the kind of communication they're hoping to foster, is going into the threads, not just the questions and answers, and learning more about thoughts or aspects of the people that you, closely. So the way that you add friends, you connect at the beginning, you can connect to your Facebook and your Twitter, or if those are already connected to your My Nintendo, that's done for you.
Good.
And then, sorry, your Nintendo account, not your My Nintendo. Mm-hmm. Here's the thing. I connected to Twitter. I could send friend requests to people I was mutually following. If they were following me and I was following them, I could send them a friend request. And the same thing it's on Facebook is if you're Facebook friends, you can send a friend request. No option to see the answers of mutual friends. No options to send friend requests to mutual friends. That's getting patched in the next update. They're saying, oh yeah, it's an oversight that you can't friend request mutual friends. We'll fix that. But as of right now, if you are a mutual follower on Twitter or Facebook, you can't add them as your friend. Or, there's a third way, if you are in the same physical room as them and you hold your phones together and select one of the four, like, heart, like the suits, like heart, diamond, club, spade, at the exact same time, it'll instigate a local area search, and you can add each other that way. So if you are standing right next to each other, or you're already established on other social media, you can become friends. If you're friends on Wii U or 3DS even, forget it. If you're followers on Miiverse, forget it, even though they have that information on your Nintendo account.
Right.
Is this actually a good product?
A product is in an app that you use on a daily basis, or a product is in something that you pay money for?
given the concept of the mobile economy is really just we want eyes on product and eventually we'll try to make it work out. I mean, I guess if you're using it on a daily basis, success? I mean, do you see people registering my Nintendo accounts to make this thing happen? Or
that's
do you
the only way you can already back up your save data, so yes.
But I mean, I think they these are people who were already dyed in the wool and were going to have Nintendo accounts anyway.
So if you have, if you link it to your My Nintendo, you earn achievements, which gives you things in Miitomo as well as other things. So you've probably heard you can download a DSiWare version of WarioWare Touched to your 3DS for 1,000 platinum or Miitomo points combined. You can get a 3DS Picross game, which I'll briefly touch on. It's 45 puzzles long.
Great.
Yeah, I finished it in under an hour. Thanks, Nintendo. And you can also get things like a Mario costume for Miitomo. So that's the only way. Linking it to My Nintendo is currently the only way to get a Nintendo outfit. There is no, outside of Miis, there are no representation of any Nintendo IP in this entire app. If you say the word Game Boy in a comment, you'll get a little bling noise, and if you say Nintendo, you'll get the sound of a Mario coin effect, and that's it for Nintendo franchises currently.
I guess it makes sense,
but
in a weird way.
They're not offering, like, Samus Aran outfits to raise awareness of Metroid, or like, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's not what I expected.
So, well, yeah, I mean, I guess it sounds like they're kind of trying to distance themselves from being just from being a Nintendo app to appeal to maybe everybody instead of just Nintendo fans that might dismiss it otherwise.
I mean, maybe. It's certainly big in Japan right now, even outside of Nintendo fans. But, if you register in the first week in Japan, they give you a Mario hat, and unless you connect to My Nintendo, that is it for Nintendo. Like, Nintendo backs out at that point and is like, here's Miitomo, totally separate.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
I mean, great, except for Miis, of course.
Except for Miis, of course. But as something to spend money on, the only reason you would spend money is if you got really into the fashion aspect of it. Because you can line up your Miis very similar to Wii Music. In a way, where the Wii Music had the album cover editor, where you can change your Mii's facial expression, pose, accessories, and you can put them on the front of a custom background. In this case, you can do it. You can change their expression, their animation, their pose, any accessories they're holding, and you can doctor it on top of any photo in your phone camera's library.
And, all right, I'm back out. I'm scared now. Scared of what Twitter's going to become.
So, also, you can, in-app, you can just hit the Twitter button, which doesn't tweet your outfit. It opens up Twitter and shows you all of the most recent pictures people have posted to Twitter.
God damn it.
It's pretty interesting, but unless you're really into that and the costumes, you'll never spend a dime on this app, ever. And I think that's why it's the number one app in Japan and not even the top 100 grossing. Because yeah. I think they backed away a little too far from the microtransactions, and that sounds really weird.
Well, like, I mean, I think it's more to seed My Nintendo than anything else.
I feel like the third app is where you're going to start seeing their true mobile strategy take place, because I feel like the second one is going to be almost equally unintrusive, but is going to leverage more core Nintendo IP, and then the third one is going to be, okay, we have our bearing. Because remember, within the next 12 months, they're going to launch 4 more apps.
But how recently did they say, like, did they set that timeline, though? Because
yeah,
Miitomo came out, so
the day that it came out in Japan, Reggie Fils-Aimé did an interview with Time where he reiterated it.
Okay, then.
He is tripling down, seemingly, on within the next year, you're going to see 4 more apps from Nintendo for smartphones, including ones that leverage core Nintendo IP like Mario.
Well
good
I mean,
luck.
The handheld market is drying up, so what else are they going to do, really?
All right. Let's let's move on.
Yeah, that's it for me, Tomo. Basically, that's my sort of verdict. Is it's fun to use, you'll never spend a dime on it.
Yeah, so, Guillaume.
So, very quickly, I went back to Breath of Fire. But because yes. I read in the comments to the last podcast that the GBA version basically cut down the grinding by doubling the XP and the gold that you get from fights, I downloaded it illegally just to check it out, just to see. And
criminal.
It was indeed very much like it cut down the grinding completely to the point where there was like no friction at all. You know, like you could just run through the enemies and you don't even notice.
Too much grinding. Not enough grinding.
Yeah, well, but that's the point. Like, despite that, the game remained kind of boring. So it points to a deeper issue, you know, like on the surface level, yeah, sure, too much grinding. But then you get past that and you realize, oh, wait, it's also not very good. So, yeah, so I'm not going to keep playing it. And I started Breath of Fire 2, but because I don't really... The GBA emulator that I tried was... I don't know if it's the emulator's fault or the fact that GBA games can look washed out because they were meant for a screen that was not backlit, etc., etc. But the game did not look super good and did not sound really good. So Breath of Fire 2 I'm playing on the Super Nintendo, and it's just as grindy as the first one. But at least it's got some more... personality to it, you know.
A lot like of those GBA SNES ports did have kind of a weird grime to them.
Yeah, and I just don't like the experience of playing that. GBA games on emulators. I guess like maybe there's settings that I could have tweaked and stuff, but I have no patience for that. I'm never gonna. Anyway, so no, I'm playing the legal version, and it's fine, but it's very, very grindy. But there's a few, you know, nice little scenes that make it sort of worthwhile. It's just that you have to work so much to get to them. No, it's pretty cool. Like, you've got at some point, like, your childhood friend is wanted because he's blamed for a theft that he hasn't committed, and so. He decides to hide, like the soldiers, the guards are knocking at your door. He hides in a garbage can and so evades the guards. But then you have to walk him to a safe house, and the garbage can is just hopping along behind you on the world screen. And so that's, you know, it's a nice little touch. And from what I've seen so far, there's quite a few of little touches like that. So. The game is more enjoyable overall, but I'm not sure if I'm going to stick with it.
That's fair. I mean, when we were discussing this series and my adoration for it, those are the memories I have of the game. Not
right.
Not the weird grindiness, the goofy, like, it's the callbacks to Breath of Fire 1 that are, you know, everywhere in this game. And they're not like up in your face, like, this is that thing from Breath of Fire 1, remember? It's just you walk past and you're like, oh, hey, I remember that.
Hmm.
But, yeah, I mean, I understand that the game is not inviting in the year of our Lord 2016.
Yeah, absolutely not. Because the whole, you know, going from the stairs to the spring to the stairs again, that was actually in Breath of Fire 2. Like, I had to level up 7 levels to get up steps. And I've had to do that for every new character that I've picked up along the way. So there's this Rand guy. He's an armadillo. And I've had to level him up and then finish like this quest to save this cat girl. And then Rand exits the party and the cat girl comes in the party and you have to level up. And it's just, it never ends, you know? Like, it's just, you have to walk around in circles so much in this game. So it's getting to me. Like, I've mentioned that I've got a deep RPG backlog, and that kind of makes it hard to stick with those games that, you know, like, oh, wait, you know, it gets good after like 20 hours, you know. It's very hard to actually stick with a game for that long when you know that you've got so many waiting.
Are you implying that 20 hours isn't a good takeoff period?
Oh my god. It takes, yeah, there's a few neat little things like even before hour 20, but I just
Yeah, I understand. Like I said, they're, for me, those neat things are the memory. But I also played it in a period where, we didn't have many of the conveniences that we've grown accustomed to. This wasn't totally out of the norm for games of the era. And
yeah.
You know,
well, back in the day, I remember like RPGs were one of my favorite genre, and I remember renting this game, Breath of Fire 2, not the first one, and I don't remember being this annoyed at it. You know, I remember thinking it's almost, you know, Final Fantasy-ish. And the sprites and the combat are really good. You know, it looks almost like a cartoon. It looks anime, but I mean, back in the day, I didn't know what anime was. That was just cartoon for me. So, yep. Like, I remember it being impressive, but...
Let me spoil something for you, Guillaume.
Yeah?
We don't have as much free time as we used to.
No, we don't.
Or tolerance for wasting time, really.
I'm also suspecting that this game was impressive back in the day because of the, you know, the huge, huge detailed sprites and stuff like that, and for the anime-ness. But today, it's not so much a kind of a thing that will make the game stand out, you know? Like, I'm sure that back in the day, people were just like, wow, a cat girl, that's awesome. But we've had peak cat girl... like during the PlayStation era, and
did you just use the phrase "we had peak cat girl" during the PlayStation era?
Yeah, we had.
I disagree, sir.
You don't think so?
I like to imagine our peak cat girl days are ahead of us, sir.
Yeah, well, we'll see.
You hold on to that dream, James. You hold on to it real tight.
If you go onto Steam, it's right now.
I guess. Oh. Yeah, maybe I don't spend enough time. Browsing Steam, but
you spend just the right amount.
I would argue if you're unaware, you're spending exactly the right amount of time on Steam. I'm gonna say that I'm impressed that of your willingness to give this game so many tries.
Yeah, no, the thing is, I don't know what to play because I'm not really into games at the moment. So I've been racking my brain trying to find something to play for the podcast. And I just, you know, like RPGs are kind of a low barrier kind of game because you can play them while doing something else. So that's mostly what I've been doing. But recently, like I've been unable to get into pretty much everything that I've picked up. So yeah, I'm just kind of in a gaming funk right now. In one of those moods where, you know, I want to stick a fork in my hand just to feel something, you know? But I'm just dead inside.
Send your suggestions to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. You will play them.
Oh, man. On WiiWorldReport.com.
All right, anyway, Greg, give me some poking.
I have a renewed appreciation for my willingness to play games now. I never really felt like it might go away. All of a sudden. As Theon Greyjoy says, it can always be worse. So, Pokken Tournament, I played the demo of this. I haven't got it yet. But yeah, the demo is very slight.
European only demo.
Yeah, as far as I know, anyway.
Not in Japan.
It's four characters that you can choose from, kind of the obvious ones apart from Gengar. But the other ones are Lucario, Charizard, and Pikachu. And you just kind of play one bout against the computer, then it says thanks for playing, and then it goes back to the start, and then, you know, obviously you can play another one. But that's all there is. But, just from that, obviously, first of all, the graphics, very, very good looking game. I mean, even a character like Gengar, who seems pretty much like a sort of amorphous blob, has got some kind of nice texture detailing on him in this and stuff. So, and especially the characters who are sort of, you know, more naturalistic to some extent, they're like fur and stuff like that. Like Lucario, like he looks really good, and some of the sort of flashier effect sequences you activate, like special techniques where, like, you know, Charizard turns into his mega evolution or something like that. I mean, it looks really, really nice. And then just gameplay wise, I think the most interesting thing about it to me, as a fighting game, is this whole notion of that, you know, it's kind of a arena fighter in one phase where you're moving around your opponent in a 3D space, even though you're only controlling it with a D-pad, as the, you may have seen the actual Pokken Tournament dedicated controller, it only has a D-pad on it, but then certain attacks will then kind of sort of set the battle then locked into a 2D plane, like a traditional one-on-one 2D fighter. So I've not nearly played enough of it to know kind of how that plays into strategy and all this kind of stuff, but it seems like an interesting idea. And of course, this is one area I feel in terms of local multiplayer where the gamepad screen being independent is cool, because it can let you have two player without in this sort of 3D kind of environment without having to go split screen. Because that's something that I did talk about this on the show, the Bleach Versus game for Wii, which was kind of an arena brawler game, and right. That had to do split screen. And in fact, even in widescreen, it wouldn't do vertical split, which was really annoying. I'm pretty sure I exhausted all my options to identify the the Japanese menus and all that kind of stuff, trying to figure out a way. But you know, when that gets split horizontally, it's just you can't really see much. So that kind of compromised the local multiplayer experience. But in this case, obviously I've not had the chance to play it two-player yet, but someone has their view on the gamepad, another person has their view on the TV. And I believe that does cut the frame rate, which is something of a shame. But that's still a much, much better option, I feel, than having to go sort of split screen or something like that. So that's cool.
Nintendo's recommendation for local multiplayer for people in the competitive scene who wants to learn it at 60 frames per second is to buy two Wii U systems, hook them up together through an Ethernet cable, and use a specific DNS router setting in the Wii U settings, and then use a hidden button combination to activate LAN mode.
Yeah, I've heard about LAN play with this. But yeah,
please buy a second Wii U.
My fighting game prowess certainly does not necessitate that investment in infrastructure, which is a very convoluted way of saying I'm pretty shit.
Yeah, it makes warp tunnel look simple.
But I am warp pipe. Was it warp pipe?
Warp
it was
pipe.
Warp pipe, John.
Sorry, fact checkers.
Well, no, John. Context. It's a reference to Nintendo stuff.
Yeah, that's the only reason why I know that.
Warp tunnel.
Yeah.
Well, it's a VPN tunnel, right?
Yeah. It is a VPN tunnel. Yeah.
But anyway, I'm never going to play. I can't even play. I mean, Smash Brothers, I've been playing consistently for, since 99 in the N64, and I'm still suck at that. I sure as hell ain't going to get good enough at Pokemon tournament to warrant a LAN setup. But, just for having fun with it, I think it'll be okay. I guess it's kind of analogous to, like, DOA on 3DS, some other fighting games. Like, we went down to 30 frames if you put it in 3D. And I didn't mind playing that way again, because I'm just not good enough to be like all counting the frames and getting everything just right. But I'm interested in Poker Tournament. I may get it at some point. But for now, I've been just getting towards the end of working through Twilight Princess HD. I won't spend too long on it because there was the whole retroactive in the episode. In the episode beautifully titled Not Take Mirror, if I remember correctly.
Yes, it was.
That covers all that. And that was linked to on the NWR front page and everything when Twilight Princess came out, as part of the sort of legacy coverage, shall we say, of that game. Some of the thoughts I've had while playing it. First of all, I think it's important to note off-TV plays. This is probably the roughest off-TV play experience I've had with any of the games. I've used that quite a lot because, I mean, the frame rate drops. I mentioned this just when I first started playing the game in the Farron Woods, but there's a lot of areas where it chugs on the gamepad. Where on the TV, the performance is pretty solid. I rarely notice any issues.
Can I offer the explanation for that?
I would be interested to hear.
So what it's doing, to the best of my technical understanding, is when it's going to the TV, it's rendering it like the Wii U would render any game. But for some reason, with off-TV play, it's rendering it for the TV, and then it's putting it through a downscaler and passing a bunch of the texture and, particle effects, and then putting it on the gamepad.
Right.
So it's running through a bunch of extra filters to try and get it to look good on the gamepad, and in doing so, murdering the frame rate when I don't want to say it's easy, but it would have certainly been less work to just try and duplicate the image onto the gamepad.
Yeah, I can only imagine perhaps that one of the reasons why they did that is because, I mean, there's certain kinds of images that seem to give the gamepad more trouble than others, aren't there? You know, I mean, it's like if you've ever played F-Zero on the Virtual Console off TV Play, and you get those areas which are meant to have kind of grit on them to slow them down. Like, that just messes up on the gamepad. You know, it just blurs and all this kind of stuff. I wonder whether they were having some issues with the textures doing that. Because compared to something like Wind Waker HD, of course, you know, you've got these very detailed textures in play, which I think perhaps it was created a sort of fuzziness, blurriness. And there's still some. I've seen some kind of artifacting and stuff playing it this way. Perhaps it was such a problem that they felt like this was worth doing. But the way I play Wind Waker HD and this, especially having played those games before, so I know what's broadly going on, I always tend to play the main thrust of the game on the TV. And then if I'm dabbling with side quest stuff or mucking around or whatever, I go off TV. And it's fine for that. You know, it's a bit of an annoyance that it doesn't perform better. It's all over. It's not just when you might have quite a few enemies around. I mean, there's the parts where you are learning the sword techniques from the hero Shade. And Link does this sort of cocky putting the sword back behind his back. It slowed down on that. I mean, so
nice.
That was kind of a shock. Like, I think you were a bit too arrogant there. You've compromised the frame rate, son.
We call that move the Funky Barn.
At least it is not Hyrule Warriors Legends on an old 3DS.
Yes, I've not had the pleasure of that. I played the demo on new 3DS.
First they disable the 3D, and then it can't get comfortably above 17 frames per second.
It's kind of borderline whether they should have released that for the old
3DS. They shouldn't!
So that's the kind of performance stuff. But, I mean, in general, you're getting all the enhancements that you're used to now with these 3D Zelda remakes. You know, managing your items is cool, a lot quicker and stuff. The gyro aiming I like a lot. It's a pretty good substitute for the pointer aiming for the Wii game. You've got you don't have to deal with waggle for the sword play, which is good. And there's a few control changes. I've seen a lot of people complaining about the horse on Miiverse and around the place, but the way I control the horse that seemed to work, which again you wouldn't have been able to do in the Wii version, is just hold forward on the left stick and then move the camera stick to turn the horse, and that seems to handle it very well. The only problems that you get is where you get into those narrow passages that divide up the field, sometimes the camera locks. So then you have to steer just with the movement stick, and then it can get a little bit weird, especially because, you know, by definition, what I just said, you're in a narrower space. But that was fine for me. And then the biggest thing about managing the horse is that you can, I don't think you could do this before, you could dismount without bringing it to a stop. You could sort of backflip off the horse, which is good if you're just riding around and you see one of those golden bugs or you see a Poe out there on the field, you know, the side quest stuff. Just flip off the horse straight away, bang the touchscreen button to turn it back into the wolf, kill the Poe, back on the horse, off we go. Very smooth, much better experience.
That's shockingly frustrating when I was doing the retroactive play, so yeah. That's good to hear.
Something gets really clunky. Out of the footage we've seen of Zelda Wii U.
You'd think there'd be some overlap there, but I mean, like I said, it's ultimately, you know, it is the same game that was released all those years ago, so there's not a whole lot left to say. One thing I'll say is, as dated as the kind of Lord of the Rings loving is at this point, even though, I mean, those movies were like 3 years old by the time Twilight Princess even came out.
Yep.
But in a way, it was ahead of its time, because the whole thing of rerunning the sort of beloved seminal installment in a franchise is something we've seen a lot more recently in the world of film. I'm particularly thinking of Star Trek Into Darkness, where, you know, you take a film, you know, a story that already existed, but now the timeline splits, so the same events happen in a different way. Twilight Princess did it first, basically, which would make
Star Trek fans are aghast.
Which would make the hero Shade Link Prime in that parlance, I believe. If I'm not
miss,
God damn it,
stay dark.
Wow.
Yeah, unfortunately, if it was really going to be perfectly an analogy, like, Zant wouldn't be Zant, he'd be Ganondorf. He'd rip off his helmet and say, "My name is Ganondorf." That would be kind of the thing there. But, you know, the big difference is that there was, like, decades between Wrath of Khan and Into Darkness, whereas there was 8 years between Ocarina of Time and Twilight Princess coming out. I think that's not to be missed.
It's kind of funny coincidence, but actually, a little known fact, Benedict Cumberbatch is Epona in this game.
He lends his vocal talents to you know, dragons and all that kind of stuff, you know, so it would make sense. Yeah.
He's got range.
Yes.
He's got range.
I don't even know what's going on right now.
And,
on the range.
And I guess the last thing really is that, you know, I this time it really kind of emerged to me how much I like the middle of this game better than the rest of it. And people focus on the slow start and stuff, which, you know, is well traveled stuff. And, you know, I think once it gets the first dungeon, you know, the dungeons, you know, get off to a nice start, like they're not too basic or anything like that. So that's okay. But I feel like you'd still have the insect hunting stuff early on, which is kind of, you know, was a little bit of a prelude to what they were going to do with Skyward Sword, you know, finding multiple uses for the environments that they created. However, I would say that Skyward Sword, at least the world seemed more designed with that in mind. They were more complex. They were more sort of these intricate playgrounds, whereas that isn't so much the case with Twilight Princess, because I think perhaps it was more layered on top. But they have been dialed back a little bit, the number of things you have to find and all that. So they go by okay. But really the last phase of the game, what I noticed this time, is just the settings remain cool, going into the sky, the Twilight Realm proper, Hyrule Castle, but the actual design kind of tapers off for me in terms of how satisfying it was. It becomes less puzzle focused, and especially in the case of the last two, lots of kill room type of stuff, which is, it happens a lot in Zelda. The very end gets kill roomy, but yes. I don't know. In this case, there's just more of it, and the combat, well, I like the hidden techniques and stuff, but they're not really particularly leveraged in the game design. There's not that much nuance there. Those areas of the game probably look the best because they're kind of, you know, more architecture sort of type environments. So the geometry isn't such a problem. You can just appreciate the lighting and the textures, and it looks very nice at that point. But gameplay wise, I kind of felt the taper off a bit more this time than my subsequent sort of playthroughs. But broadly, I've enjoyed it, and I'll probably do a lot more of the side quest. I've probably already done more of the side quest stuff than I ever did originally because of off-TV play compromise, though it might be.
Fair enough. John, I'm going to let you actually talk very briefly, and I'm going to hold you to this.
About
the Halo World Championships.
I
want something a little fire. So,
all right,
let it go.
I guess I'm being the flavor guy here. All right, okay. So the Halo World Championships, I really just kind of watch this on a lark. I don't usually watch esports. I watch some World of Warcraft stuff, but not often. So, but yeah, this was last weekend, and it was interesting just to kind of see, because I will say that versus the WoW stuff I've seen, the Halo stuff it's just a lot better produced. I'm sure there's a lot. I mean, the play by play guys are a lot better, and you know, for the finals, they did, of course, have to bring in Blair Herder, of course, who dropped a couple of cringeworthy mother jokes. And I was like, of course, they have to have, you know, everything was played straight to that point, which was totally cool. I'm down with that. But I'm just like, why do you have to bring in the host to make the mom jokes or the stupid jokes, like, at every single gaming event? So that was disappointing. But aside from that, it was pretty good. It was pretty entertaining. And what was interesting is the way it translated. You know, because I'm a big sports fan, so, you know, I'm used to kind of watching, you know, like the NBA Finals, stuff like that, that kind of format. And this was a similar format in that I watched pretty much from the quarterfinals through to the finals, I think. I watched, three rounds. Their format moved from best of five to best of seven. For best of seven was the quarterfinals and the finals, and then previous to that was all best of five. So, relatively. They switched formats. They switched the matches. Typically, they went from, they have strongholds, which is kind of like you have 3 points and you have to capture them and hold them. And if you get all 3 points at once, you score triple the points. Right.
Old Battlefield style.
Kind of, yeah. So it's and that's an interesting game type because there can be wild swings. So right at the end, somebody can come back really quickly. Like you can be down, it goes up to 100 points. And so you can be down 20 points and all of a sudden a couple things fall your way and you can make up 20 points just like that. And right at the end, it comes really close. And especially you're dealing with really, really good good players. So that kind of stuff can happen. And then you have typical, team deathmatch, and then you have capture the flag. And it was just interesting because, you know, there were a couple of series that, you know, one team steamrolled the other, but there was one series that was really, really good where, you know, this one team that everybody was cheering for had this guy on it who was a longtime Halo veteran, very well known in the scene. Been playing for 10 years, but he was always kind of the bridesmaid. So it was interesting. It was interesting seeing this, you know, how they always do this in
I like this guy already.
Well, it's yeah, like yeah. It was interesting because they what I thought was interesting about it was that. They kind of tried to build his story up, right? Like they had, you know, you're so used to in normal sports seeing these kind of fluff pieces like so-and-so.
The narrative.
Their narrative. So-and-so came from a hard background and he had to deal with this and that. And they kind of did it for this guy, right? And I was like, yeah, it kind of worked. Like it worked. Like I bought it, right? And so it was interesting. It actually got me more interested in the match and seeing this guy. And it dovetailed nicely with the match itself because this guy's team went way down pretty much to the equivalent of, you know, like his team was, I think it was a best of five. His team lost the first two matches. Third match, they were down. It was capture the flag and you have to get 3 flags to win and they were down 2 flags to zip. And then they came all the way back and wound up winning the entire series. So it was really cool. Like it was, everybody was really into it and really cheering for it, for his team and everything. And so he eventually lost in the finals, but it was good. Yeah. So his whole thing continues. He's always the guy that everybody wants him to win, but he always loses. He's like the Cubs of the Halo scene. Right. So
how many times has he made it to the finals in a row, John?
I don't know, but he's like the guy that's typically like top three. Every time, but he never wins.
Oh.
So yeah, he gets kind of burned.
That's what you get playing in the worst conference, I guess.
But yeah, so it was interesting. Like I felt like it was the first time where I actually watched something in esports, and like that's the thing. Like I hadn't played Halo in a while, so I wasn't really, you know, really I couldn't watch one of the game types and be like, right, I know that, you know, I know that, you know, that stage, and you know. But it was interesting because the more I watched it, the more I kind of became accustomed to the pace of the game, which is really, really quick, and just kind of like, you know, they switch, they have like spectator mode where you can see where, like, and of course the players can't see this, but you can see a view of the action where you can see through walls, so you can see where the other enemy players are as they relate to the camera view of whatever player you happen to be using at the time. So it's kind of neat. So they
so you actually have control over like where what you're seeing.
No. They switch that.
Oh, okay. Because I thought this was some kind of interactive thing, which would have been amazing.
No. Although I'm sure they could probably do that. I mean, I could see it going that way. Although I question. I could see them doing that, but they weren't doing that in this broadcast. But
right.
I'm sure they have the tools to do so. I mean, they do. But yeah. So there was. So in that sense, it was guided by the play-by-play guys. But they sort of know. They know everything inside and out. So I didn't really mind that. But yeah, but I mean, it was really good. I mean, I came back and watched the finals, and you know, one team steamrolled the other, but it's interesting to just kind of see it developing because they're trying to like build these players up, and of course I was watching it on Twitch, and the Twitch chat was hilarious. It was like a viewpoint into the stream of thought of like a 16-year-old, and just it was so hilarious. I mean, if you've ever seen a Twitch chat, I mean, it goes by, and it was really funny because it was going by so fast because I think they had about 90,000 viewers at one point for the finals.
Jeez.
So, yeah. But it was going by so fast, and just all the memes that are in there, and like, you know, it was really a small crowd in their studio. I think it was held in like Burbank or maybe Hollywood is where they had it. And And it was really funny.
Live from City of Industry.
Yeah, it's
like Halo World Championships.
From Torrance, California.
But that's not fair.
But yeah, it was just, I mean, it was just funny because, you know, anytime that they would show, you know, some girl doing something or whatever, it was like, grill, 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 grill. You just see all these people making a comment about a girl. Like, it was so ridiculous. It's just a huge stream of consciousness kind of thing.
I will say, as an aside, Twitch just released the ability to replay the chat alongside of past broadcasts.
Why would you ever want that?
It's like your first instinct is why would you ever want it? But then I'm like, that's completely brilliant. Seeing it match up in real time is hysterical. Because it's just, I mean, you just grab popcorn and you're like, what are these people? Like, because you can see what, it's great because you can see exactly what people's visceral reaction is to anything at any given time. And it's surprisingly, like, uniform. You know? It's like, you're
like, that's the best part.
Yeah, like, you just sit there and you're like, this just happened. Watch the chat. You're going to see this. And it's like, all of a sudden, it's like ridiculous memes and crazy ASCII art all the way up. And it's hilarious.
This is why I hide the chat on every live stream.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really funny. But yeah, it was good. I mean, it'll be interesting to see kind of where it goes, but definitely esports is definitely getting better. It's definitely getting more professionally produced, and you know, I mean, it was obvious that Microsoft put a lot of money into this. I mean, I think the prize was 2.5 million, I think, for the finals, like total. That was a total prize pool, and the winning team got $1 million. So that's serious coin. I mean, split between five of them, so that's, you know, 200 G's a piece. That's a lot of money.
A lot of the esports is driven by the publisher of a game.
Mm-hmm.
What I wonder about on if right now we're in this publisher-driven esports presentation model, I feel like that has to change because publishers are going to want to change games at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, unless you're like Riot, I guess.
Yeah. Well, that's really what they're trying to do with Halo. I mean, Halo is like long-term. Like Halo's going to be esports forever kind of thing, just, you know.
Yeah, but they're going to have to put a new Halo out.
Exactly. Yep.
And I wonder if these games become pigeonholed in such a way, like, well, we can't change it too much because it's got to be Halo for the esports Halo. Like, does that feed back into the game, or if Microsoft says, okay, we're done promoting Halo 5, we don't really have anything to go for a while, does Halo esports suddenly lose some of the appeal or the mass market possibilities? Like, it's difficult when the people who are pushing an esport are the people who are trying to sell copies of the game, because at some point they're going to move to the end of life product cycle for a given game.
An analogous thing is when Super Smash Bros. For Wii U and 3DS were getting built up in their marketing machines, respectively, Nintendo started getting really cozy with Evo. And this year they're having Melee, Wii U, and Pokken at Evo, but what happens next year when they're not trying to sell you Pokken, the Wii U DLC is dried up? Are
right.
they
like,
as supportive
is,
of Evo? Like, do
and
they,
is, does it get?
Yeah.
Do they push the center stage? Do they put their marketing muscle behind it? Do they make sure all the right bits and bobs are there needed, like, to run a tournament? Like, how?
I'm sure they give the thumbs up for the game, but do they promote it themselves?
That's exactly it. Right. So that's the thing. It's commitment level. How committed are they to esports?
Yeah, and how committed are they to this esport versus whatever their current game they're trying to sell for the bottom line is? Because ultimately, for Halo, Microsoft needs to keep selling Halos.
Yep.
Which means there needs to be a Halo 6.
But, like, let's say by June 2017, we don't have a Splatoon. Like, is Nintendo still running Splatoon tournaments at that point, or have they just moved on?
I think if they're making a Splatoon 2, I think they're running it. If they're not, I think they aren't. I think that's what it comes down to.
But yeah, but it'll be interesting. It'll be very interesting to see what Nintendo does, because Nintendo, like, I can't see them positioning Splatoon as an esport. Like, you know? Like,
they have in Japan.
Yeah, right? It's
but
weird.
Running competitive, highly competitive tournaments.
Like, I can see it, though, but I mean, like, actually, like, going, like, saying, okay, well, we are going to have Splatoon as an esport. So we are going to make our production, you know, like, the way we produce this game is going to be geared with esports in mind, not just, we'll release another Splatoon when we feel like it.
Right.
And maybe it'll have some esports features, maybe not. That's not really our gig.
because that's what I expect from them. Whereas, right. you know, everybody else, Halo, you know, whatever, they'll be like, yeah, we're going to, you know, have this out for, you know, this championships. It's going to have stuff built in so you can stream it online and you can – and anybody can, you know, put like some nice GUI overlays. Like all that stuff will be baked in for esports, right? Whereas Nintendo would probably be like, eh, we like to make games. And if they're esports, that's cool.
I feel like the I think Nintendo developers won't try to position games as esports, but mm-hmm. Nintendo marketing and events coordination probably will.
Yeah, I could see
and
that happen.
That's probably the right balance for game development. I think if you lean too hard into the esports, you do run the risk of just the game you've built just isn't fun for everybody else.
Absolutely. Street Fighter V.
Yeah, it really depends. That's the you know, balance you have to strike.
Right. Mm-hmm. The game needs to appeal broadly enough to cover its costs ultimately.
Yeah, and I also think, I mean, really, like, I mean, my initial take on esports after watching the Halo Championships was like, yeah, they need to, like, kind of make it look like you can be, you know, older than 20 to actually be effective in any of these things. Because,
that's
I mean,
not,
when,
that's not fair. You're
yeah,
way
but,
too
I mean,
old.
But seriously, though, pretty much the
you're
oldest...
way too old at 20.
But, yeah, I mean, dude, they had guys there. I think the two final teams. I think the oldest guy on there was 25.
His handle is Grandpa.
But yeah, but I mean, you could easily watch that broadcast and say, yeah, I mean, there's no point in even playing these games if you're like older than 25, pretty much. I mean, like people
better join the Wii Bowling eSport League.
Exactly. But it's something like, yeah, like, I mean, like you have players that are like, well, you know, I've been a pro Halo player and I'm 28 and I'm over the hill. Bye, guys. I'm retiring. Like, literally. So that's kind of something that long term I think esports will have to deal with. And that goes with any game, really. It's like, you know. But,
yep.
But yeah, cool. It was cool.
Well, John.
I enjoyed it.
John, you know, you threatened in the email, in our planning emails, that we would talk about this and it would turn into a 15-minute philosophical discussion. I concede that for once, even when I promised I wouldn't let it happen, it did.
Yeah.
You're right. Congratulations.
Surprising no one.
Yep.
Surprising no one. So I want to get – I am playing – oh God, I'm blanking on the name. So this is a problem with this,
8140?
With this game. Yeah, so this
– 6180.
6180 the moon.
Go.
And that is the worst name, period, ever, of anything.
It really is.
Like, I can't remember the four-digit number. I told myself it's 6180 the moon. But I'm not going to talk about it today because I want to concede a little bit more time – so let's Saran talk about one more of these Japanese games. I will talk about it next week. We had some people ask if anybody else played it. I have played it. I've got thoughts. We'll get to them. But Saran, I'm going to let you pick one of your two remaining games.
So I've been playing two games. The Japanese version of Tokyo Mirage Session Sharp FE, known in Japan as Genya Ibun Roku Shaku Wefui, and Shin Megami Tensei 4 Final on 3DS, which is not a remake.
Known as Never Coming Out Here.
Never Coming Out Here. No, it might, I don't know. It's a sequel to Shin Megami Tensei 4, not a remake. They said that we added Final to it so that it was clear it was a sequel and not a remake. And
that mission failed.
Mission failed outside of Japan. Also, the two paths in that game, you either kill the idea of polytheism or the idea of monotheism. So your final battles are either Krishna or the Christian God. So, that game. But, so, Genya Ibun Roku, Tokyo Mirage Sessions.
Spoilers, I guess? I don't even know.
No, they've said that in the announcement.
I feel like I've been drinking. What just happened?
The Polytheistic Alliance. Anyways, Tokyo Mirage Sessions.
Don't ask, just worship.
Yep. So, Tokyo Mirage Sessions is the crossover game between the Shin Megami Tensei franchise and the Fire Emblem franchise, but it's the most important thing to remember when talking about it and having a conversation about it is an original IP. It is not a Megami Tensei game outside of its battle system, and it is not a Fire Emblem game outside of its upgrade system and some characters. I was telling James earlier, you're not going to find... You'll find Jack Frost cameos. You're not going to find Jack Frost in this game. You're not going to find Pixie. You're not going to find any characters from SMT.
You're not going to find penis chariots.
Sadly.
Sad.
It is a game that takes place in the Japanese pop idol industry, and on its surface in the advertising, it's just like, hey, here's a J-pop music video that the characters are recording, here's the logo of the game, here's the release date, buy it. And because of that, the game tanked in Japan, dramatically. What it's actually about in the idol industry is, here are idols, they all hate this industry. Here's an alcoholic, drug-dependent manager who is just crumbling to pieces. Like, here is a dance trainer whose name is Barry Goodman, who's the opposite of an otaku who is obsessed with the US, but also Barry Goodman. But
sounds like a Resident Evil character.
Some of his writing. Anyways, so it has a sort of Persona 4 vibe in that sense where all the characters are just incredibly dissatisfied with their lives in some different way, all in the larger scope of Japanese pop idol business. Now, the reason I haven't beaten this game yet is because in Chapter 2, and this will probably get, quote, censored, unquote, thankfully, this should not have been in the original Japanese game, there is a 16-year-old girl in your party who becomes a pop idol at the beginning of the game, breaks into the industry, and in order to distract an enemy shadow, like, basically demon-infused paparazzo, you basically find a porn magazine, make her dress up like some of the actresses in that, and then the paparazzo starts taking, like, upskirts of her. And that's, like, the distraction scene. And I was put off of that game for about a month and a half. But I'm Japan. Back now. I'm back now, and the battle system is what is keeping me going. So, if you know what the SMT battle system is, great, I'm not going to explain it, go look it up. But it builds off that. So it has that, and it has the weapon triangle for physical attacks from Fire Emblem. So it has swords, lances, and axes, and bows, actually. So, weapon square in this case. And it strikes an interesting balance where the enemies, you can attack their weakness, but unlike in an SMT game, it's not going to do a ton of damage. It'll do a little bit more damage, but not a lot. So what you actually do there is, this is why TMS is not just SMT backwards, it's also the perfect name for the series, because the battle system is all about session attacks. So when you level up, you get your skills, like your ice skills and your fire skills and whatever, and then you also get session skills. So if Tsubasa has a session skill that allows her to follow up a super effective ice attack with a thunder attack, then even if you don't have Tsubasa in your party of your party of three, she will follow up after your attack with a second attack, and then a third person can come in, and then a fourth person can come in. And because of this, it's not a game where you pick two or three party members and keep their levels current, because the way you attack is you have five people in reserve, and you launch one attack, and then this big session comes in and starts pummeling and pummeling and pummeling, and all those are free turns. So they don't affect turn order whatsoever unless they kill the opponent, in which case that enemy is just removed from turn order. And so you're constantly keeping an eye on turn order, and if you hover over an enemy with an attack that's going to be weak, it'll show you some of the session, but it's also up to you to remember, okay, these are the people in who will session attack who are in my party, but do I have anyone in reserves who will do the session attack? So that's sort of the core of the battle system, and then you have weird moments. Like, I discovered while playing 20 minutes before we recorded, and I told James about this, I don't know what's triggered this yet, and I'm 45 hours into the game. But I just used a normal lance attack with Tsubasa, the aforementioned 16-year-old who broke in, and suddenly she started reenacting a soft drink commercial that she shot earlier in the game on the beach. And so she stripped into her bikini, started spraying soda at the enemies, and then the ocean came and drowned the enemies, and then she jumped 200 feet into the air and stabbed them all with her spear. I don't know what caused that, but I'm interested in finding out. It's
understatement of the year.
It's a really fun game. It knows what it's doing. The story is pretty dark. The game is going to be rated M. Spoilers. They said that in the announcement at E3. The trailer was prefaced by, this game is expected to be rated mature. It's very much going to be an M-rated game. It's very, very dark. But the battle system is it's really innovative, and I wish it had a demo. I wish it just had a demo that went had you take go through three encounters, like maybe two random enemies and then a mid-boss, because I feel like that would sell a lot of people on this game. So this dovetails into SMT4 Final. So Genya Ivanroku's structure is very much like a Persona game or a Devil's Survivor game, where there are side quests, there are character-specific missions, but the main quest is fairly linear. You go out, there's structure, there's waypoints, there's all this stuff. And that's lovely, and I love that type of SMT. But SMT4 Final looks at it and says, okay, if you got into SMT with Personas 3 or 4, then you played SMT4, which was the bridge title into core SMT. Here's a fucking Super Nintendo SMT game made in the modern day. Where you exit the tutorial and everyone is 15 levels stronger than you, and you have to start figuring out the negotiation system immediately. You have to start figuring out that battle system, your partner skills, your stat buffs and debuffs. You have to figure out everything. You have to do spreadsheets. And I love that too. I really do. But if you're not playing on an easy difficulty on SMT4 Final, that is SMT4 Final. It is very much a, if you beat SMT4, this is the next step from there. Because SMT4 ends right around that point, if you're playing on normal, hard, or risky. And I'm playing on the normal difficulty right now in SMT4 Final, and man, I have gotten my ass kicked. They removed the one concession they did make is in most SMT games, you die, you go back to the title screen, you load your last save. That's just how it's always been. In SMT4, they sent you to the underworld, and you started like bartering with the gatekeeper of the River Styx using play coins. They just removed that. You just come right back. It's a lot simpler to try your battles again and sort of learn the mechanics, learn everyone's strengths, learn everyone's weaknesses, and go out and kill Lucifer or God or Krishna.
Hey, we made this game too hard. Our bad. That's literally the admission here. It's like, we may have overdone it this time.
Well, there's a DLC there's a free DLC they released a couple weeks after the game came out with an easier difficulty setting.
The apology tour begins. The apology tour begins in DLC this week.
Players were also complaining that they grinded to level 100 and still couldn't beat some bosses. So there's a free DLC coming that removes the level cap from 100 up to 999.
I like the idea that
what a solution.
I like the idea that Atlus just decided to not playtest this at all and just said, "Fuck it, here we go. Have this game." I can't beat it.
The thing is,
ever.
They did. They playtested it similar to. The first time I was on, or second time I was on, Guy was talking about Soul Hackers.
Yep.
It's playtested very similar to Soul Hackers and classic SMT games like that.
Oh, good. Yep. Yeah, it's the Sega Saturn era is where we should draw all our inspiration from.
I mean, like, SMT3 Nocturne on harder difficulties, for instance, or the Digital Devil Saga, or I could just name drop any number of these games. But, like, if you can play Persona 4 Golden on risky difficulty, which is the hardest, then this will be no issue for you. But it's still very fascinating that these two games came out, both Atlas developed, but both by two different teams, a couple months apart, and the split in Atlas has actually been published. So what happened was the SMT4 final team was the director of SMT4 left the team, and then the team was like, what do we make next? And then someone from the team apparently piped up and said, I know, I used to work on old SMT games. Whereas the Genya Ebenroku team was the all-star development team. It had the director of Radiant Historia and the Devil Survivor games and SMT4. And that's Genya Ebenroku. That's Tokyo Mirage Sessions. And then SMT4 Final was just old veterans getting to make their passion project.
Just and, sadists.
And so I really appreciate both of them, and I really love having both of them at the same around the same time, because I'm bouncing back and forth, and I'm getting both ends of my RPG spectrum sated. I would not recommend SMT4 Final to just about anyone.
Strong recommendation.
If you like how I described it, if you played Fire Emblem Conquest on Lunatic or Lunatic Plus and managed to breeze through some of the chapters and Classic and managed to breeze through some of the chapters, give 4 Final a shot if it ever comes out here.
If you hate life, this game is for you.
I wonder if the difficulty is part of what's maybe keeping Atlas's jets cool on this one.
I think the fact that an hour in, you get told explicitly all religion is a lie. That's a direct quote. Like, that's like on the back of the box, I think, even.
That's a good start.
I think that might have something to do with it. But, no, I say this as someone who is burned out on Lunatic Classic Conquest on the final boss. It's probably around equivalent to Fire Emblem Fates Conquest on Lunatic.
Great.
In terms of the strategies you need, in terms of the, well, I can't let her get too much EXP, because if she gets over-leveled, then my entire strategy from now on gets fucked. I can't let anyone get under or over-leveled. Also, there's multiple different endings, of course. So keep replying.
Oh, God.
Depending on your dialogue, there's, instead of law neutral and chaos, I think they described it as chaos, true chaos, and pure chaos.
God damn it. All right. That's enough of this. I was on board when we were describing the Fire Emblem Galgun crossover I always wanted, but now I'm off. I'm off the trip. I need an adult.
I was looking forward to both these games, but I didn't hear anything about any cat girls, so I'm just like, meh.
Oh no, there's absolutely, you can dress Kiria-san, I have her in this right now, as a cat girl, which gives her a stat boost.
Oh, good.
Guillaume.
I'm back.
Guillaume is back.
Thank goodness.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have our first sale.
Good, there's going to be 4 sales in the West. Oh, by the way, Tokyo Mirage Sessions is completely coming out retail. That's not download only.
Why?
I thought it was going to be download only.
Anyway, that's enough of this, because I hurt. I hurt inside and outside. I need a break. And what we're going to talk about on the other side of the break, I know I said emails were back, and emails were back. Past tense. They're not back anymore. Instead, we're going to talk about rumors, which is appropriate, because today, well, thank you, Internet.
Mwah. Thank you.
And we're back. I almost said it's time for listener mail, but it isn't. Because this week we're not doing listener mail. You got a lot of it last week. We'll make it up to you later. But you can still send us your listener mail to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. It's our email address. So you put the listener mail in the email, you put it to the address, and then it comes on the show and we read it and we give you half-assed answers. That's how this works. But this week we want to talk about something else that is also half-assed, I suppose. I don't know. Transitions are hard.
It fooled a lot of people.
It did. NX rumors. Not specifically NX rumors. That's kind of the on-ramp to this conversation, but more about rumors in this industry explicitly. So if you missed the last, let's say, week and a half of just the internet imploding on itself, there was a image that came out of a oval-shaped thing, like a screen, that the only interactive surface on it appeared to be two control sticks that looked an awful lot like slide pads, or whatever we call them now. I can't remember. What's circle pads?
Nipples.
Yes, we don't call... No, not nipples. We don't call them nipples. That's not in the Nintendo style
you
guide.
You may not.
Nipple pad
okay, fine.
Thank you, Siren.
I regret everything. I'm full of regret right now. Anyway, the image was much circulated on the internet as being the controller for the console, all caps, bold, NX, that like had features no buttons. And of course, Photoshops happen on the internet. It's not a big deal. And there were some people who thought, yep, Nintendo's just lost it. This is the controller. This is the real thing. This is what's happening. Everybody get down. The fires have started. Because it was, admittedly, conceptually not necessarily convincing, but from a actual production of the image, it was very convincing. It looked very good. And unlike some other Photoshops that we've seen in the past. Now, of course, this triggered all kinds of the internet research machine and the internet panic machine to fire into full power at all times. And, like, the image that was used on this screen was traced to, like, an Unreal 4 demo. Uh-huh. But then everybody said, well, okay, it's fake. But then somebody else came back and said, hold on, actually, this is an Unreal 4 demo showing off their engine for tap controls, and then like the thing really went into overdrive, and we thought we had gotten through it until I guess it was 2 days ago. Uh-huh. Another image came out of a black controller that looked mostly the same, a little bit different, in a different setting, and then suddenly, oh god, this might be real. And the internet just imploded on itself for a solid day and a half, until finally somebody released a YouTube video showing how they made this image, because it's not real. And it was, I would say, one of the craziest panics I've seen since the last time Nintendo was teasing us with what their console was going to be. Which brings up a question. Uh-huh. And I think I've fairly covered what how this whole thing went down.
Well, I guess the biggest thing is the resemblance to the patent images that have emerged.
Identical.
To some extent, maybe in some people's minds, it gave it credence, and then in other people's minds, well, it's just a fake based on those images that were alongside the patent. So it was kind of really whatever you wanted to make of that connection.
Well, there wasn't a stick figure on the screen, so...
That's true.
Yeah. That's right.
On a more pressing point, there weren't handles, which the patent had, which made people panic even more of, how do I even hold this thing?
How did I hold the NES controller?
I forget now. Was it with my feet?
Yeah. Yes, with your mouth and your feet.
I could so beat Glass Joe with my feet. That's a true story. He's really easy.
So that led to people doing things like using other objects in the image to try to establish scale and figure out how
big
it is.
The tree
means that it was made by the Division developers.
Yeah.
Reflections on the glass, like things got out of hand quickly. And to a certain extent, and I guess this is going to get to where we're going on the conversation of just like, just what the hell, internet? But more specifically speaking, how much of this at a high level? So, combining the two threads for the Photoshop, there is about 250 pages of posts on internet firestorm NeoGAF. That's probably the nicest way I can put it. Just controversy machine NeoGAF. Where things like this can get out of hand very quickly. Like on NWR, because it's slower paced and most of the people who go there regularly have been through this before and just go like, no. This isn't how this is going to go down. It doesn't spiral. But here, people feed off each other because there's so much action, and people come back and see, like, oh god, the thread's gained 20 pages. Why? How much of this do you think people just engage in because it's fun? Now, I don't mean creating fakes. That's obviously a lot of fun. But how much of just, like, engaging in this rumor machine do you guys do? Like, reading and consuming the stuff that you know deep down, like, this is not real.
Not a lot. Not these days, anyway. It was a lot more like back in the early days, you know, of the internet and all, you know, go back to when, you know, NWR was Planet N 2000 and all the stuff around the GameCube,
right,
and all that like that, and Wii as well, because Wii was a bit special.
Wii was very
it?
Weird.
Yeah.
Yes.
But, you know, these days not so much. But I mean, I could see the fun of it. I mean, even stuff like. Oh, I mean, I obviously read like loads of forums about the bills, and there's still people making the same jokes about like, oh, somebody saw this guy at the airport from a coach in search in like the early 2000s. You know, like it kind of just passes into legend, this stuff about,
nice,
you know, for the people who've been in the scene for ages. So I think there is a certain amount of fun even for people who have been through it all before, just, you know, going through the mill again, even though they're probably the people who are less likely to, you know, wig out or whatever over it and just see the funny side.
I just feel like things are so easy to fake now that it's, I mean, unless it's something, I mean, the only way that I give anything any credence is if it, number one, looks like Nintendo hardware that didn't even look like Nintendo hardware that anything Nintendo would ever make.
Developer hardware might surprise you. It doesn't look Nintendo like.
Yeah.
Okay. But I would say that the issue that, and I'm trying to remember who I originally saw say this, it didn't look super rugged. Like, it looked...
No.
Oh, that's way too
polished.
Like
something...
Yep.
Yeah.
That's my point. It looked like Sony equipment, if anything.
Yeah.
You know, the kind of stuff that you would never hand to a kid because you'd be afraid the kid would drop it and completely destroy it, like an iPhone. Yeah.
But you could tell it wasn't a Sony product because it didn't have proprietary memory slot on it. Oh.
Yeah, and it was actually, somebody was actually using it. Oh. Well,
oh, God.
At least,
all right.
At least with
Vita. Vita means death. So, I don't normally follow threads like this because I just don't care. But for whatever reason, I kind of watched this thing just spiral badly. Because there was a weird sense of just like people who were convinced it was right, it was real, because it fed into their worst fears of Nintendo. It validated all of their worst feelings, and so therefore they wanted it to be right, which was weird.
I mean, like censorship.
How appropriate in this election year.
You get that a lot in both positive and negative. I mean, it's like, again, with the Bills analogy, there's so many, even now that our former owner has passed away, the explanation for anything bad is Ralph is cheap. Like, that's it.
Moving to Toronto.
You know, that is just like, oh, you know, we're not going to sign this guy, or, you know, oh, we'll probably draft O-line instead of linebacker. Then Ralph is cheap. Like, it's you know, like, people want to believe stuff. They just fit it into their own views, you know, whatever it is.
I don't understand why people would jump on an obviously false leak, you know, just to get indignant about it. They can't do that when Nintendo actually announces stuff. Like,
that's right.
I remember when Nintendo
gives you
announced
a reason to be mad.
I remember when the Revolution was announced to be called the Wii. I just laughed my ass off. The forums
the
just
Wii,
exploded.
Just Wii. Remember, it's just Wii.
Just Wii, not
yeah,
the
Wii,
not
Wii.
Nintendo Wii, just Wii.
Right.
Just Wii.
And just people could not believe it, and they were so... And I don't know, it was the funniest thing. So, like, we can have that for real, you know? Like, why
yeah,
jump on a rumor?
Sure.
We don't need that to get manufactured.
I mean,
that's
right.
I
think maybe some of the deepening kind of the spiraling, perhaps, reaction that went on it might have been a bit fueled by the Nikkei report about the end of NX production coming around the same time. The end of Wii U production coming at the end of this year. I think even though they're not necessarily that closely related or anything like that, it just maybe it did stoke the fire a little bit.
But you're right, though. There was a weird confluence of stuff happening. And then at the same time, there is this, and we get it, you know, we get it in our inbox, we get it, people, you know, putting comments in the threads for the show. There is this appetite for just like, all right, Nintendo, just fucking tell us what NX is.
Yeah,
that now I think has turned people, I'm trying to remember the expression about a man who has not eaten in a long time. Something about all food looks like a delicacy.
And if you feed him fish, you'll feed him one day. But if you teach him how to fish,
thank you, Guillaume.
We teach people how to disentangle rumors sort of quite well for themselves. You know, this wouldn't happen, but we just don't do that. And so it's just
we have
social malaise.
We have 50 podcasts a week to produce, Greg. I don't want to teach them shit.
So yeah. I mean, people can't stand not knowing, and they like to feel smart. So.
There are very good reasons why Nintendo announces hardware when they do, why companies announce hardware when they do. Especially because a lot of the time, if they run a risk, and it's a two-edged sword, where if they don't tell developers about the system before the public, then people will like look at the initial reveal and be like, well, they didn't have a sizzle reel of Randy Pitchford saying that Aliens Colonial Marines is going to be the best on Wii U.
God damn it.
So, like, clearly.
No Pitchford, no sale.
Yeah, but just like, look, we didn't have the third parties, right? Why didn't you talk to the third parties? But if they're too open, like, too loose-lipped, then you get all these rumors, which, like, let's pretend for a moment that we live in a world where the Xbox One DRM didn't actually happen, but it was rumored that it would, and that was so prevalent before they announced, it would have almost the same effect in the public eye. Because the first thing they hear about the system is what sticks. And so they don't want rumors about this kind of stuff, or leaks, can be extraordinarily detrimental to their business. So their platform's future health. So they definitely don't want that, but they also can't remain silent because they need, especially on NX, especially after the complete clusterfuck that was Wii U, you need to go on there next to Square Enix and Capcom and Bandai Namco and get on with gung-ho, get on with everyone you possibly can who would ever want to develop for this system and say, all these people not only know what it is, they have dev kits and they have games shipping in the first 12 months. Like, they need that.
Yeah, but the challenge is, once you say, these people know what it is, like, every person in the media is going to be like, do I know anybody who works at Namco Bandai?
No, you do that at the announcement.
That's when you have to do it. So, we've talked about in the show that their hand was forced by the mobile announcement to there's another game system, don't worry about it. And then unfortunately, if you combine that with, you know, the commentary that Mr. Iwata made before his passing, like, that's just enough, like, just slightly obtuse enough commentary that it even makes rumor mongering that much easier, because you can go and create fanciful scenarios based on what, you know, the things he said.
Well, the other thing I would say timeline wise, if you consider, for instance, like you said, I've said before, I agree that, you know, they probably were talking about future console a bit earlier than they would have liked to, because they had to reassure everyone that, you know, this mobile announcement is not some sort of off ramp out of the console business, out of the dedicated hardware business. But to the point we're at now, where we all feel like, certainly I do, as I mentioned on the prediction show, you know, that the some form of an NX product will be launching before, you know, the fiscal year is out. You know, might not make it for the holiday season, but I would anticipate if it doesn't, it would at least come out before the end of the following March. Then, you know, you compare that timeline with Wii, where, you know, you had the Revolution E3, where they just showed a case, but they were still being coy about the controller. They still showed the controller around about TGS the following September. Mm-hmm. So that's more than a full 12 months before the product launch. And that was something that, you know, was the big mystery, was what the controller was going to be. And, you know, the idea that, well, maybe it's going to get plagiarized and all this kind of stuff. And we still had, you know, after all the crazy mock-ups that went on during that rumor mongering season and all that, we still had the controller unveiled and saw it, you know, more than a year out. Whereas if we go with the timeline that it's coming in this fiscal year, we're already under that for NX. So I mean, especially with the early build-up, you've just had a hell of a lot of time, and just the social media, everything's kind of accelerated from where it was 10 years ago. You've had ample opportunity and fuel to the fire to get to where we are today.
So, just using hypotheticals on NX, the announcing the Wii controller didn't sabotage necessarily future GameCube sales, because especially at that point they hadn't, I think they had alluded to Virtual Console but not confirmed backwards compatibility with GameCube. Is that correct? Wasn't that E3 2006 that they confirmed
GameCube? That might be true. They definitely announced the Virtual Console at the first E3 NX.
Yeah.
Wii was at.
That was
basically all they said.
Yeah.
They said it was like three DVD cases tall and it's got Virtual Console.
So, especially then, that didn't necessarily sabotage a lot of GameCube sales, because the GameCube was, to its detriment at the time, a fairly traditional games device. It didn't have very many consumer-facing revolutions, which is why, you know, Wii was codenamed Revolution. But by announcing like the Wii Remote and saying, oh, this is motion control, that's very much announcing not like a third pillar, but a different type of device, and if you wanted the GameCube games, you still had a year to do that. On Wii U, which is back to being mostly a traditional games device, if hypothetically, the NX has the capabilities of being a traditional games device, in some skew, in some mode, in some way, whatever. If it has that capability, and that's its predominant capability, especially if it's backward compatibility with Wii U games some or all in some way, goodbye to every system sale for Zelda. Goodbye to even like Holiday Rush. Goodbye to just about everything for any informed consumer at this point. So I feel like they have to wait until E3, if it is launching this year, because how are they going to announce the Wii U, which is their second biggest hardware failure, including Virtual Boy? How are they going to announce a successor to that and then wait over a year?
Well, like if the problem is getting rid of the stocks of the Wii U, I say drop the price.
They haven't been that aggressive with that.
Yeah, not everyone has $300 or even $200 to spend on
the
console.
They've been doing bundles and stuff to improve the value proposition, but actual hard price drops is still not something they've done. But I think the point is as well, though, when you consider that it's on course to sell about 70% as well as GameCube did, probably something in that area.
Uh-huh.
There's not that many sales that they'll be losing at this point, I'm afraid. You know, that's the other part of it. It's so out of gas that the opportunity cost is not that great. Zelda point is probably the one remaining kind of interesting factor in that.
That's the last gasp.
Well, without getting too deep into the strategy of announcing a console, which if you go back to what happened with this generation for the PS4 and the Xbox One,
well, you get two people in the line at GDC.
Well, yeah, that yes, but I mean, they weren't nearly as proactive about, you know, announcing way ahead of time. This is what it is. This is what it's got. Because we were still really learning about those consoles in the lead up to E3, the E3s that they headlined. Mm-hmm. Like, we were still learning a lot of details about those systems. And in fact, Nintendo, if shit hadn't leaked on them, Nintendo would have basically been doing the same thing with Wii U, because they were still doing a lot of this is what the, because they had that whole like Nintendo Direct like 2 days before the their E3 stuff.
Mm-hmm. They announced Miiverse and
yeah, and generic action hero. So they were still you know, there's definitely been this sort of move towards, we don't necessarily need to show the product, you know, a year ahead of time, and that may be partially
course,
be driven, I mean, by the
of course DS was very sudden. There was, you know, yes, very very particular reasons for that, you know, because they were trying to kind of head off the PSP at the pass, as it were. And ultimately was successful, you know, but made for a kind of a rough initial period in terms of, you know, not particularly replete with the greatest amount of software and all that. And of course, mm-hmm, like the first model they showed was even uglier than the original DS Fat. And
that
then
one
DS,
was
the DS Fat one, very nice and all that. But ultimately, you know, that compressed timeline didn't hurt. The DS went on to be tremendously successful. So uh-huh, it certainly doesn't suggest that does any particularly lasting damage.
Well, think about what the consumer electronics space is now. It's, if there even is a product announcement for a new product, it's usually like, oh, and it's out tomorrow. Out in a week.
Yep.
Now, obviously, with a whole new video game console, it's different, obviously, because the games need to get made, and you can't keep the Sega Saturn quiet all the way up to the day it comes out. But you can certainly bring the window closer. You could certainly time shift four. You don't necessarily need to show off. Like, think about, when did we see the game? Well, actually, let's go back to the N64. When did we first start hearing about Ultra 64? It was a long ways out.
The first mentions of Project Reality, which was the code name before Ultra 64, go back to the end of 93. You know, like, so like, it was like a 3-year build up with that, but that is, mm-hmm, very much, mm-hmm, out there from the N64 experience. It's nothing that anybody wants to go through again.
I mean, Nintendo's been coy about this. I don't think I'll get in too much trouble for saying this. NX has been in production since 2012. And especially because the specs were almost all announced in E3 2011 for Wii U. And they were like almost final at that point, like a year out before its full system unveil.
But right, because you need them to make the games, effectively.
Exactly. And getting developers on board. And for that matter, before E3 2011, we had, like, by this point, like March 2011, we had fully drawn diagrams of the gamepad with descriptions of every component in it. Like, oh, here's the NFC sensor. And so to Nintendo and their developers' credit, they've kept legitimate, like, especially if these leaks had been legitimate, that is a long time to keep your legitimate leaks quiet.
Yeah, they've certainly managed. Maybe that is the trade-off, that why we see so many leaks everywhere else about directs and all this stuff. Is all their counter leak efforts are going
are
to the
teams.
New console.
Those are different teams.
Yeah, no, of course they are.
Well,
but
the direct one was amazing though, because it was just a press kit. Like, somebody got the press kit and didn't realize, like, either it's like, fuck this NDA, I don't give a shit. It's like,
it is, kind of funny that we've got these two things happening pretty close together. That, you know, the people sort of, you know, there's a certain amount of grouching about the idea that directs are getting spoiled because Nintendo can't keep anything under their hat, and then we've got, you know, sort of rumor mongering implosions and everything going on because Nintendo's keeping it under their hat too much with the new system. So there you go. I think it's different teams, different priorities, all that kind of stuff. But it just shows you how these things can go both ways.
Marketing staff don't have details on the NX.
We were talking about this, that people inside of the industry have actually been remarkably good about not making a lot of noise. Because with Wii U, ultimately it was developers who kind of let all the stuff out.
Western developers, mostly.
Yeah, that seems pretty amusing now, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's some irony there.
From what I understood, the leaks were coming out of studios like EA, Ubisoft, and 2K. And studios that publisher holds. It was not coming from, like, Tomorrow Corporation, who had dev kits, or Broken Rules, who had dev kits. It was not coming from them. It was not coming from the small studios that were so indebted to Nintendo for trusting them with this information and, like, working their butts off to keep it secret and keep this, you know, be able to support the system at launch. It was not coming from the small studios. It was coming from, well, I'm a janitor at this company, and we've just had the dev kits laying around, and I guess I didn't sign an NDA. Like, here's all the information. Whatever.
Yeah, like keeping something like this secret really does just depend on ultimately the players, because what we were talking about at one point, we determined that of the people who know what the NX is, you can probably count executives at Sony and Microsoft among their number.
Oh, absolutely. Because Microsoft knows.
Because ultimately, they have very intimate relations with the same people who have these things.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, you know, it came up. But ultimately, there's been remarkable amount of just keep the wall up, don't say anything to the press. It's been fairly impressive. And I don't know how. I don't know how they've pulled that off this time. But, I mean, good job.
Again, I think it's, for better or worse, I don't think Ubisoft has dev kits for the NX in all of their studios. I don't think EA ordered that many dev kits, if any. I don't think that Gearbox has dev kits for Battleborn. Like, I don't see big Western studios. This is not, I want to be
right,
very, very,
is,
very
this
clear.
This is based...
This is not based in anything.
This is not based in the conversation.
We have seen Western devs complaining that, boy, it sure would be nice if Nintendo would tell us something about NX.
Yeah, and I mean, you have Square Enix, who has announced 3 games. You get Western studios. There are absolutely Western studios holding dev kits. 100%. Indie devs. Some have dev kits.
Well, so speaking as a developer then, and yes. I'm not going to ask you to go into any kind of secrecy here, but like when you're approaching a platform holder for the first time, mm-hmm. is it a fairly formal process? Like how does that happen?
A lot of it happens at events. Microsoft and Sony don't talk to you unless you've shipped a game. Nintendo really either. And a lot of it is like how forthcoming you are, because obviously like the tech support people, those people are always going to be available. But
right.
The content publishing team, if you ask Nintendo, if Nintendo gives you permission to develop the game for their system, and then you make it, and then you send it to them, they will put it on sale, but you're going to catch them so off guard, because basically what you're doing is just saying, here it is, and they're like, we have no spot to promote this, this could be the best game on the entire system, and you gave us no warning.
Is that how you get on the also available on the eShop this week list?
100%. Those are also just games they don't have faith in. Like if you, for instance, with Monochrono, Monochrono is targeting Wii U, and I have been vocal with Nintendo. I send them emails frequently being like, hey, do you want to see what I've got? Do you want to talk about this? Do you have feedback? Do you like this? Do you think this would be a good fit? They love that because not only do they get to help give feedback on the game that they're taking a cut of, but also just in general because they know where your title is. They know when to expect it. They know they can approach you then about promotional opportunities because, for instance, if your game, they don't know if it's at a state for to show in a sizzle reel for E3, they're not going to ask. If they don't think your game is playable yet, they're not going to talk to you about it. Like, why would they? They're not going to try to spam you. But if they know what's up, tell them what's up. Mm. So sort of from a developer's perspective, it's about like open communication with the platform holder.
So we got way off topic. But I wanted to go down that route because one of the big rumors that came has come out of the only stuff we're hearing are people who are saying they don't know what Wii U, or excuse me, what NX is. They don't know what Wii U is. That's a different question.
Still today.
I just wanted to kind of plumb that one a little bit because I think right now there is just this fear and negativity about Nintendo in general amongst some portion of the gaming community that's willing to believe the worst. And so things like this random company says they don't know what NX is, you know, it gets brought out to nobody has dev kits or whatever. I did want to kind of at least speak a little bit to what establishing a relationship looks like and working with a company as in a third party relationship. But broadly speaking, I think the reason these rumors go out there is because people are just hungry for anything right now. Yep. And there's nothing happening.
It's a big pent-up demand for it right now. If you compare it to previous timelines, this is a big gap between that original phase of like, okay, this is hardware, it's coming out in the future at some unspecified time, to actual meat on the bones. I can't think of a gap as long as this. Apart from maybe some weird N64 stuff, but that was so long ago, and pre-internet mostly, it's apples and oranges.
Can I ask you guys two opinion questions? The first is, do you think that they're going to be as forward-facing on the controller after what happened with Wii U? And the second is, do you think they're going to have two presentations at E3 again, one with the hardware and one just about the games?
Forward-facing, they're going to do something, and I don't know what that means yet, but they're going to do something.
I think the big thing about the controller should be, and this isn't just specific to the controller, I guess just features in general, is that there should not be a feature around which, that the platform ends up having a sort of millstone around its neck in terms of the market. You had a bit of that with stereoscopic 3D on 3DS. I know you would go on to get the 2DS and they kind of righted the ship and it's put up respectable numbers, but that was a problem. The gamepad has been a problem for the pricing and all that. So I think going along with the family of systems idea and all that, I'm not sure that there would be maybe like one particular feature that defines the entire platform. I think you might get options. But they wouldn't be so strongly sort of, as you say, they wouldn't be so forward-facing on that stuff. They would be options, because I just think that's, they made the one mistake with 3DS, and then they made arguably the same mistake much more egregiously with Wii U, so they should really avoid making it a hat-trick.
Yeah, I would say, Guillaume John?
I think that the controller will be so integrated that they'll have no choice but to show it with it. And I think that there'll be two separate events. Yeah, I think they'll show off, because everybody's so curious about the console. They'll show that off first, and then they'll say, okay, well, come to this other thing, and then we'll dive into the games.
And the games, Guillaume. Yep.
I just think that the controller is going to be the draw. So, as it was supposed to be, or has been with the Wii and the Wii U. So.
Right. I'm just thinking back to the initial marketing struggle.
The N64's controller draw. Anyway, we got off topic, but I think this is kind of one of those things that lends itself to ending up in a meandering place. So, Serrano, I want to thank you for being here.
You mean it's a Skype call with the four of us on it?
Yeah, well, that's true. You threw the five.
No, but we don't require you to meander.
True.
I can. There's audio evidence of this. I don't know whether know where to find
hundreds
it.
And hundreds and hundreds of hours of it.
Oh, I know.
So I was going to give you your Monochrono pitch here, but you can say what it is, although I think you've said it on the show before, so...
Monochrono is an upcoming 2D arcade shooter that is coming to just about every platform. It's going to be at E3. That's where you're going to be able to see gameplay, see trailers, press hands-on. In about a week, I'm going to be sending out an announcement that says my upcoming content slate. But I've got another game other than Monochrono that's shipping in a couple months. It's just about done. I've got Monochrono, which is my big, big title. And then I've just recently announced a title in development for PlayStation VR, which Sony confirmed, which is coming first half of 2017.
Busy. You're a busy person. Very busy.
This is why I only have time to play two or three games for free. Or for fun time.
Two or three gigantic games. Anyway, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
And I want to thank Guillaume, Greg, and John for putting up with this.
Oh, I think you're forgetting to thank someone, James.
I don't have to thank myself because I know who actually runs this Titanic. That's going to do it this week. Thank you for listening or for just downloading this because iTunes does it automatically and ignoring it. Greg, what's our music this week?
Our music this week suggested appropriately enough by Chris for the anniversary of the Resident Evil series that just came up, 20th anniversary. He requested a very relaxing theme for the save room from the GameCube remake of the original Resident Evil.
Perfect. And on that, save me. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Later.
Bye-bye.